This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Is there thing you've reached at in terms of, like, what have you...
Okay, ask your question, Neil.
So what is your education, you can say, in that aspect? Like, what have you reached?
Oh, what I read? So what I did was, because I studied in Saudi Arabia as a child, I was able to read two texts in Madhab al-Hanbali as a young. So I got to read Zad al-Mustaqni, and I got to read Al-Rawd al-Murbi', which are very, very, very influential books in the Madhab.
What do you mean by read?
Like, so like in a halaqa like this, similar like this, the Shaykh would be reciting the book and explaining, and we would be sitting there taking notes or something like that. And I was pretty young at the time, but I was lucky to attended those two when I was kidding. I took a number of other texts in different, not in fiqh specifically. When I went to Syria, my imam, two of my teachers, one of them was a fiqhi Shafi'i, very committed fiqhi Shafi'i, and the other one was a fiqhi Hanafi. So I was able to read two texts with each, and I continued in university to read another two texts in Madhab al-Shafi'i. So I read four texts, preliminary, secondary, tertiary, and then a large text. We went through al-Majmu' in about 6 years, throughout patches of time. And when I found myself doing that, I decided I was going to continue to do the same for the rest of the Madhab. So I read four books in each Madhab. I had two in each. I had nothing in al-Fiqh al-Maliki. We had to go search out a scholar in Fiqh al-Maliki. So I did Maliki the last thing that I got to study. I studied it later because there was just no scholars available. I had to go search them out and read Matan ibn Ashir and Mukhtasar Khalil, and we went through four books, starting from preliminary, moving up to a fourth level or a resource book. So in every madhab, you want to do a preliminary text, a simple text, then a secondary text, which is usually an explanation to the preliminary text. You want to do a tertiary text, which is a text that is considered a secondary resource, marja', and then you want to read a resource, like a marja', a book like Al-Mughni. For Fiqh Al-Hanbali, we started with, like I told you, just Zad, and then Rawd Al-Murbi', then Sharh Al-Zirkashi, and then after that, and then you go to Al-Mughni. Al-Mughni is the is the ultimate place to go, and you read that, and when you've read that, khalas, you've read all that you need to read in the Madhab. You see, if you want to actually read all the books of Fiqh in a Madhab, you need maybe 5 to 6 lifetimes at least to be able to read just one madhab. It's impossible, the number of books that are written. You cannot read them all. There's no point in reading them all. It's all the same stuff. It's just worded differently or small. Like, you have to read a whole book to maybe get 3 extra pieces of opinion. Read a book that's 1700 pages for 2 pieces of opinion. I'll come up with an opinion on my own. It's too much work. So what you need to do is just 4 books per madhab. That's what I did, and that's what I promote. You do 4 books, preliminary, secondary, a tertiary, which is a secondary resource, and then an ultimate resource within the madhab. And that way you've actually studied a madhab in full, so you know everything you need to know about it. And I was lucky by different times of my life to study different books. And then I finally, when I was older in my early 20s, I completed each madhab by reading 4 books in all, and that way I feel it's just very easy for me to to talk about a madhab. I don't feel I don't feel lack of confidence. I know what I'm talking about because you've studied a book into detail. But they do take time. I spent a lot of time,
in our day and time, if you don't have a degree,
To be honest, my degree didn't really do that for me. It's side knowledge, but I got the degree because it's important to have a degree today. At least you need that to kind of certify yourself and validate your ability to speak. But it's really not the degree that gave me the knowledge. It was.
Which degree?
So I have a bachelor's degree, a 4-year degree in Islamic studies from Jamiat Kulliyat Usul al-Din from Jamiat Umm Darman Islamiyah, and it's a 4-year, it's a bachelor's degree. It's 73 subjects with a thesis at the end. And I started my master's, but I didn't complete my master's because of the war. But it didn't really offer me the knowledge. It's the side. I built friendships in the university. 6 guys, we did a book club. We would take, for example, Bada'i' Sana'i Imam al-Kassani al-Hanafi, which is the resource in Imam al-Hanafi. You study that, you don't need to know anything else. Now, if you could study that right now, I wouldn't tell you to study the first 3 books. But the thing is, you can't. You start with that book, it's too hard. It's way too hard. Like, you'll be reading, I have no idea what he's saying. So you have to start with the preliminary text, secondary, tertiary. You're building your ability to understand their terminology and their lingo. And then when you read this book, you'll understand it. And that's all you really need because it's the ultimate resource. But it's a huge book. It's 25 volumes. So I would take 4 volumes. I would give a friend 4 volumes. And then we would go for 6 months. You would read the volumes and take notes. take like a and then we would come and we would just binge study this thing for like a week. We would go to our I had a friend who had a house in Qusayr, which is just outside of Homs, and he had like two elderly parents, like extremely elderly parents, like they didn't even they couldn't even hear, like they could you speak to them no idea, and he had like his open room and he would just go and sleep there for a week and just study. Everyone give. Once we had, we added a guy to our group because he was studying a big book. I think it was in Mughni. I'm not sure if it was the same book, but we gave him three volumes to read, and he came with like a paper and a page and a half of notes. Like, what did you do? Like, we each of us had like two notebooks full of notes, and he had like a bit like, we had to take the books and study them and come back 2 months later to actually do it. Because the skill of taking notes and being able to explain the notes to the person in front of you. So I would explain my my part that I read, and then you would explain to me your part. It would take, but you're winning colossal amounts of time. Like, you are winning so much time, it's not even funny. Like, to study a 25 volume book is going to take you, five, 6 years. But do it this way, and you can do it, you can actually fit it in within a year. Like, 6 months of you studying the number of volumes you want, and then maybe a month and a half of you and your colleagues studying the book and explaining things, and you're walking away with a lot of information because you're photocopying their notes, and you're taking your own notes, and you're building your own knowledge base. Yeah. So it's really, it really makes a big difference. And that's how we did a lot of my studies. A lot of my studies were based on that. And then we would take that, وَنَعْرِضُهَا عَلَى imam. You would present it to an imam in the madhab, because Damascus was known for having a very large amount of scholars from different denominations of Islamic knowledge and different madhab. So we just go, we would present him, this is what we did, this is what we studied. Usually the scholars would be like, they're quite impressed with the effort, because it was a big effort at the time, for us to be young and doing that. Not many people did it, but so he would either certify us or validate what we learned. So I don't have certifications in all the books that I studied, but I do have in a good amount of them. Like, I can certify in all preliminary texts of the form of Dhahab. So I can give you a certification in Abu Shuja, I can give you one in Kanz al-Daqa'iq, I can give you one in Mukhtas al-Quduri, is also Hanafi, I can do that too in Hanafi. And then I can give you in Matan ibn Ashir or Mukhtas al-Khalil, either of them, because I did both. And I can give you something in Zad al-Mustaqna for Fiqh al-Hanbali, with the preliminary. The higher books differ. I have a lot in Shafi'i, I have some in Hanafi, and maybe one in Hanbali, but I don't have a lot, because it's hard to do. Like, to actually get a scholar to certify you in a big book, that usually requires a long period of time of you just reciting to them. And I didn't have all the time in the world to do it. Sometimes I would come and say, like, I read the book, I want to Adil Alik. And he would say, oh, you have to come every day for the next 6 years. I'm like, okay, salam alaikum, jazakallah khair. And then I find someone else who's much more open, who, like, a couple of sessions within a couple of months, I present him with my knowledge, he asks questions, we discuss the book, he feels like I know what I'm doing, and he'll certify you to start teaching him. So that's how you should do it. I don't know, I can't tell you that everyone who studies Islamic knowledge has done that. I did it because my teachers were very, they emphasized a lot the importance of knowing all that can be known, and to certify yourself and to actually seek knowledge properly. And I was lucky in that sense, because I was guided by very, very intelligent people. I was guided by very, very open-minded, intelligent people who wanted you to learn from everyone. And that was just the fadl of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then I was just surrounded by good friends. I don't know where they are right now. It's funny, like, two of them were taken at the beginning of the Ahdath by the forces, and I don't know if they are alive, if they they came out or not. And two of them are in Turkey, and one of them is in Germany, and we're all over the place. We have a little group that we talk every once in a while, but it's kind of gone. But we spent a lot of time you should do that. Look for people who are willing to study with you, because that's how you do it. You can't study alone. It's impossible. You read this book by yourself, you're not going to read it. Have someone who's reading the second volume, and you're going to have to meet with him next month. You'll read it, because you're going to look like a jackass if you're sitting there and you haven't read your part of the book, or you don't know what it's about. So it really helps you if you can find a friend for talab al-ilm, a friend to help you seek knowledge. It helps you with the Quran. That's why halaqat work for the Quran, and individual learning doesn't really work very much. You kind of lose motivation, and it works for any other type of knowledge seeking. But you have to look for a group. You have to build a tight 4 or 5 guys, and then you start looking for someone who has an ijazah in a certain book. You guys take the book, you read it, you come, you discuss it with him, you get the knowledge that you need, and you're ready to read. It's not impossible. We sometimes are made to feel that learning Islam in depth is an impossible task. Like, you cannot do it. It's way too. It is not impossible. It's just like any other knowledge in the world. You can do it. You just have to be with the right people. You have to spend the proper amount of time. I mean, there's a certain amount of time you have to spend. It's not going to happen with, it's not like studying from university where you can cram like your whole thing in 2-3 nights and pass and end up, I passed this. You pass the subject. Are you certified in the content? Like, remember when you crammed, you crammed before, right?
Yeah.
And that's all you do probably. Like, so if you crammed before, so you passed your, yani, whatever, give me an example of it.
Math.
You passed your math. So you passed the course, but my question is, are you certified to teach the content inside of it? Okay, so that's for the difference between Islamic knowledge and what we do today. In Islamic knowledge, you have to be certified to teach it. Like, hafazt the Quran, I memorized the Quran. Are you certified to teach the Quran? No, then you haven't really memorized the Quran Islamically. And you could have an agree that I memorized the Quran, someone signed it off for you. If you're not certified to teach it, like, you don't know it well enough, you don't know the tajweed, and you don't know the articulation and the pronunciation points, and you don't know the actual surahs, and you can't teach it to someone else and actually benefit them, then you're not ready to, it's not considered. So it's more learning through competency instead of learning with merely just a mark in a course or it's actually learning through you know your material, and for me that really went a long way. Like, it helped me a lot in my life, always learning with competency. I'm trying to learn something so I know it, so I can explain it to you so you can understand it. If I don't know it that well, then I don't really know it. Then I just, yes, I passed the course, I have a 60 or a 70 or an 80 or a 90, but I don't know how to teach it, then I really didn't do anything. Did that answer your question in general? So I think that's what you should think about when you're alright. Go ahead. It's on?
The whole time.
This whole thing? Okay. Musiba wallahi. Okay. Yeah, I know.
Or now they know the general path, right?
Yeah, inshallah. I'm happy to offer the help, inshallah, as we go along. It's not as hard. I just need shabab indom himma. I just look for guys who have some I'm not seeing enough of it. Like, there's no urge to learn. Like, that's the problem. Like, learning is something that has to be self generated. It has to come from you. You have to really want to learn. Like, you have to be, I want to know this stuff. I want to be someone who's educated and intelligent and understands all of this. No one's going to tell me. For me, I didn't want anyone to tell me what's halal and haram. I knew what's halal and haram. You can't tell me, because I was tired, sick and tired of everyone telling me, oh, this is, you can't do this and you can't do that. And I'm totally confused because I don't know. Everyone's telling me something different. So, like, I will know what's right and wrong. I'll tell you from now on, or I don't want to tell you actually, I just want to know for myself. And then after that, you start building more and more intention of learning. Like, this is actually interesting, actually a lot to benefit from, and you just keep on going as in terms of knowledge. I just don't see the himma is an important part of learning. Okay, so we'll start with bab al-nikah. Al-nikahu wa ma yata'allaqu bihi min al-ahkami wal-qadaya. So kitab al-nikah. Can you turn on the lights for us, all the lights? Jazakallah. Kitab al-Nikah, the chapter of marriage. Where is Abdullah Khan? He's not here. Miskeen. He's gonna miss out on all the good stuff. All right. So you'll enjoy this, inshallah. An-nikahu, يقول الإمام أبو شجاع رحمه الله, an-nikahu مستحب لمن يحتاج إليه. Marriage is recommended, so it has a religious status. Now, it's not just a thing that we do; it has a religious ruling. Religious rulings are either haram, you can't do it, makruh, shouldn't do it, mubah, no one cares, mustahab, is recommended, or wajib, you have to do it. So where does nikah fall? For the Shafi'iyah, it's mustahab. For other scholars, for other madhab, they will talk about it being a bit higher. Like, some of them will say it's wajib, specifically in certain situations. But here it's mustahab, generally speaking, لِمَنْ يَحْتَاجُ إِلَيْهِ, for those who are in need of it. Meaning, if you are a functioning, physiologically functioning male or female, and you need marriage, then it is recommended that you get married. Meaning, you get ajr when you get married. And you don't get wizr, you don't get sin for not getting married, unless you make a mistake. Unless you fall in haram, you say, well, it was hard, yeah, but you could have got married. Right? It was recommended that you got married. You got married, and you didn't get married, that's your choice. Now you have to live with the repercussions of that choice of now committing zina, la samahallah, or committing a sin. So that's something to think about. وَيَجُوزُ لِلْحُرِّ أَنْ يَجْمَعَ بَيْنَ أَرْبَعِ حَرَائِرَ وَلِلْعَبْدِ بَيْنَ اثْنَتَيْنِ. As I said, we're going to find a lot of rulings regarding slaves. Because at the time there were so many slaves. And there were rulings in Islam to maintain their dignity and to make sure they had rights. They're not going to have equal rights to everyone else because they're still slaves. They will have equal rights the moment they buy themselves out of slavery and they can live as a free person. But they do have rights. Before Islam, slaves had no rights at all. I mean, they weren't considered human beings that were going to be given rights. But Islam came and actually gave them rulings and gave them rights. And it's acceptable, it's permissible for the hur, for the free man, to marry up to four free women. You're allowed to marry up to four women. And for a slave, he can marry up to two. He can't marry up to four. So almost, you're going to find most of the rulings in Islam is whatever is for the free man, a half is what is going to be considered for someone who's a slave until they can get themselves out of slavery. Yes? Ruh al-Qud lak. I know, mashallah alaykum. Yes, you can have them all if they're... Because I doubt like more than one or two or three goats are looking for you. So there's no... So you're not going to... وَلَا يَنْكِحُ We should edit that out, inshallah. Remind me to edit that out. وَلَا يَنْكِحُ الْحُرُّ أَمَةً إِلَّا بِشَرْطَيْنِ And a free man should not marry a slave woman except with two conditions. عَدَمُ صَدَاقِ الْحُرَّةِ He does not have the dowry to pay for a free woman. وَخَوْفُ الْعَنَةِ And he is fearing falling into zina. Al-anat, which is zina. So, Islamically speaking, and this is not just for the Shafi'iyya, this is for the majority of the madhahib, the majority of scholars, is that a free man should look to marry a free woman. That's what he should be doing.
And both men and women, right?
Yeah.
Like, a woman also should.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, it works both ways. You should be looking to marry a free woman, unless you can't, you're too poor to afford it. Or, you may make money soon, but you're fearing that you're going to fall into zina. So, you're going to marry a woman who doesn't have slavery. And this is to encourage people to free themselves out of slavery. Everything in Islam is either is closing the doors that lead to slavery and encouraging people to free others and for slaves to free themselves. To get out of slavery so you can live a full life. Because it put the system of getting out of slavery. Islam put the system. Because before there was no system. Yani, you could be a slave who has $1 million, but you can't get out of slavery. Because no one wants, they want to sell you, they want to offer it to you. But Islam forces you have to do it. If you have the money, you can go to a judge, you can get yourself out of slavery. So you're encouraged to do so that everyone's free. And that's how Islam basically got rid of slavery in most of the Islamic parts of the world, and within the first 200 years of its existence. But still, a certain amount of these people existed for quite some time.
So this is saying if a person didn't have a customary amount of mahar, then he could look towards one of his slaves.
Yeah.
And then does he still give a mahar to the slave?
Half of it, right? So we'll come to that in a second, inshallah. Yeah. But yeah, he gives half of the mahar to the slave lady. Okay. وَنَظَرُ الرَّجُلِ إِلَى الْمَرْأَةِ عَلَى سَبْعَةِ أَضْرُبٍ And for a man to look at a woman, there are seven different situations. Now these are important to understand and understand that there is context to them. Meaning that not everything we're going to read is agreed upon within all scholars. I disagree with certain points of it. But generally speaking, it's a nice way to look at it. He says, أَحَدُهَا, the first one, نَظَرُهُ إِلَى أَجْنَبِيَّةٍ لِغَيْرِ حَاجَةٍ فَغَيْرُ جَائِزٍ For you to look at a woman who is not mahram to you, she's not your mother, your sister, your daughter, your aunt, your nephew, your niece, and she's ajnabi to you for no reason. And this is talking about just staring. She looks good and you're just looking. Just following her, looking at her. That is not jaiz in the deen. If you're looking at an ajnabi, there has to be a haja. So there has to be a reason, meaning you're talking to her. You're conversing on a subject of importance. You're visiting. At their families are visiting and you're talking. So but if you're just sitting there and everyone's talking, you're just staring at this girl. Right, just looking at it, she doesn't know. That's haram. And this is what he's talking about here, Imam Rahimahullah. So be mindful of that as a man, that you shouldn't be looking at women for no reason. If she's talking to you, look at her because you're talking. It's very rude. But not, you're just sitting around. Don't be staring at them. And we all know that we tend to want to do that all the time. So be mindful of it within your own self.
Maybe in regards to looking like physical looking? Like all seven of them are looking.
Yeah. Talking about eyesight, so anyone who's blind doesn't have to read this at all. Which is true. وَالثَّانِي نَظَرُهُ إِلَىٰ زَوْجَتِهِ أَوْ أَمَتِهِ For him to look at his wife, whether a free wife or أَمَتِهِ, which is a slave wife, either way. I mean, she's still a slave. She's a wife, but she's still a slave. فَيَجُوزُ أَنْ يَنْظُرَ إِلَىٰ مَا عَدَى الْفَرْجَ مِنْهُمَا You're permissible to look at her as much as you like, except for the farj. The farj is the السوءة, which are the genitalia. Now, that is not the prominent position for the Shafi'iyya today, or for any of the madhahib, by the way. So this was the stance for the madhahib back maybe 100,000 years ago. Today it doesn't stand for different pieces of evidence that exist, and just for general fiqh jurisprudent discussions that have happened that show really no reason for this to be there. But this was mostly built on a hadith where Aisha radiallahu anha said, "La ma ra'aytu minhum wa la ra'a minni." The Prophet never saw. I never looked at that part of me. I never looked at that part of him. But the hadith itself lacks authenticity, and there are other pieces of evidence that suggest suggest otherwise. And there's really no reason for you to Islamically to limit or restrict al-halal when there's really no restriction for it. So when you get married, yani go crazy, do what you want. Like, it's really up to you what you. But I will warn you that what they say here is not just based on evidence, also based on experience. That doing that all the time is not the best idea. Meaning there are certain parts that aren't supposed to be exposed all the time. Exposing them all the time can mess with your sexuality. It can mess with your understanding of sexuality and your interest in it and the way that you deal with it. That's why we dress in at home. When you're married to your wife, you're not, if you're alone, you're not sitting naked all the time. You're dressed. Well, why are you dressed? You don't have to be dressed. It's just that's a better way to do it. If you're not dressed all the time, that actually it can mess with your understanding of things. So do take what he said here, rahmatullahi alayhi, with some level of respect, that there is some benefit in what they're saying. But generally speaking, this is not the prominent position for the Shafi'iyya now or for any of the other madhahab at this point. وَالثَّالِثُ نَظَرُهُ إِلَى ذَوَاتِ مَحَارِمِهِ أَوْ أَمَتِهِ الْمُزَوَّجَةِ فَيَجُوزُ فِي مَا عَدَى مَا بَيْنِ السُّرَّةِ وَالرُّكْبَةِ. For you to look at your maharim, your mother, your daughter, your sister, your aunt, your niece, your granddaughter, your grandmother, and their sisters. Oh, amati muzawwaja, or a slave, your slave that you own, who is married to another man. Fayajuz fima adama bayna surrati wa rukba. Then you can look at her as long as you're not seeing from the navel to the knee. Right? So, and this is the Shafi'i position, and it's the Hanbali position as well. The Hanafi might have a bit of a different look at this. We'll talk about that, inshallah, as we come to it, because it's too detailed. But when it comes to your mother, you're allowed to see the upper part of her body. You're not supposed to be looking at it, but it's not haram for you to see it. It's haram for you to see your mother from her navel to her knee. I know this doesn't really happen very often, but this is the hukum shari'i that exists. I tend to decide by the opinion that's not in this book. It is one of the aqwal for the Shafi'i. It's one of the opinions of the Shafi'iyya themselves and another texts and of the other madhahab as well. For your maharim, it's not from the navel to the knee. It's from the chest down to the knee. So the bosom also being covered, and then you can look and talk and you can just stare. Like, it's no problem because they're your maharim, because you don't have any sexual needs towards them. But I tend to take that position to find that a bit more authentic. However, when it comes to your mother breastfeeding or your sister breastfeeding, that's, I think, where this becomes more applicable. Meaning that for you to see that is not a problem.
But say your mother is in old age and like you take care of her. Like,
that's different. So now when you're a caregiver, that changes the whole thing. The moment you say a caregiver, all this doesn't count anymore. You're a caregiver, you do whatever you need to do to care for her. You take off all her clothes and bathe her, and that's all fine. Like, it's your mother. But we're talking about here, generally speaking, that's not the case. What are you allowed to stare at? Because there's no, here talking about bidun haja, there's no necessity. I'm just sitting there. Can I just stare at my mom or stare at my sister? Yeah, that's fine. As long as you're not looking at anything that exposed from the knee to the navel, from the navel to the knee, right? But when there's a need, when there's a haja, things change. I mean, there's a need for me to be looking here, whether it's medical, which will come in a second, like in the same text we'll talk about medicine, or it's for caregiving, or it's for any conversation or anything like that, then things change. Like, the rulings change when there's a word need inside. The same thing goes for prayer, for example. Moving without need in prayer can ruin your prayer, three movements. But when there's a necessity, like your phone goes off, whatever movements you need to turn it off, because you're moving with purpose.
For the Ahnaf, it's three movements. And then for the Harabila, short movements is okay as long as it's not consistent.
Yeah, but when they said that, they were talking about movement that was purposeless. Are you saying what I'm trying to differentiate? All of them, when they gave these rulings, they were talking about purposeless movements. This was later on continued to even purposeful movements. But when you look at the actual text, like the actual nus of what Imam Ahmed said or Abu Hanifa said, it was talking about purposeless movements, meaning purposeless, they mean like scratching your nose or fixing up your thobe. But when there's a purposeful movement, things...
When the Prophet, he was carrying a baby, so that's a need.
There you go. So you drop the baby, you'll die, and you'll kill it. Or if you need to move out of the way because like a car is coming. So a purposeful movement, there's much more flexibility in terms of things that are purposeful. And the same thing goes here in terms of your eyesight. When it's purposeful, it's different. I mean, there's actual goal that you know what it is. Like, it's not just... Because when there's no goal, that's where shaitan comes in. he starts to give you goals, like give you things to think about when you're looking at something that's not halal.
Scratching your nose is not purposeful, like.
Well, it's not a necessity because you'll live, like you won't, yeah. You know, you'll make it. You don't have to do it. But for example, your phone goes off, you're distracting everyone in the masjid. No, you should turn it off immediately and take as many movements as you need to do that. Okay. وَالرَّابِعُ النَّظَرُ لِأَجْلِ النِّكَاحِ فَيَجُوزُ إِلَى الْوَجْهِ وَالْكَفَّيْنِ. And the fourth is looking at a woman with the intention of marrying her. The intention is I want to marry this person, so I want to look at her. So you can look at the face and the hands. Other madhahib have made permissible a bit more things, the feet, hair. Some madhahib have made that acceptable, meaning you'll find difference of opinion here. The Shafi'iyya are very strict on this. It's just the face and the hands. So if you're sitting and you're thinking of marrying someone, so you can look at her for no reason. Again, just talk about looking, no reason at all, you're just staring. But if the point of this is I want to marry her, so I want to actually look at her features to see if it's something that I'm going to enjoy and I find her attractive or not, then that's fine. The Prophet ﷺ actually would tell the Sahaba, Anas ibn Malik, or I think was it Anas, or? I don't know. It wasn't Anas. I think he's the one who was narrating the hadith. I forgot, subhanAllah. But he said that a man came and said, Ya Rasulullah, I have did khutbah with a lady of the Ansar, from the Ansar. And he was a guy from Mecca. So definitely wasn't Anas, because Anas is an Ansari anyway. But he told him, أَنَظَرْتَ إِلَيْهَا. Have you looked at her? And this hadith is in Muslim. Have you looked at her? فَقَالَ لَا. قَالَ اِذْهَبْ فَانْظُرْ إِلَيْهَا فَإِنَّ فِي أَعْيُنِ الْأَنصَارِ شَيْئًا. Go look at her, because there are something about the eyes of the Ansar, they're different than us. Look at her, see if you find her attractive, because you may not find her attractive. So the man went and looked at her and he said, I'm good, Ya Rasulullah. So you continue. But he was commanded to go look, go see, go make sure that you're okay with the way she looks. Because that's an important part for men.
What if she has like a deformity that it's not
mental? Yeah, so be patient, they'll come in a second, inshallah. It's a part of you'll talk about that specifically that point. Well, Khamisu, the fifth. And نَظَرُوا لِلْمُدَاوَى, to look for the purpose of healing or for caregiving. فَيَجُوزُ إِلَى الْمَوَاضِعِ الَّتِي يَحْتَاجُ إِلَيْهَا. You can look at whatever you need to look at. Whatever is needed at that time, you look at. It's based on necessity and on purposefulness. So a doctor can, a lady is giving birth, the male doctor can look at whatever he needs to look to make sure that the baby comes out easily and the woman doesn't bleed out or die. That's fine. So there's nothing haram about that. That is something that all madhahib agree upon with no difference of opinion almost at all. The only difference of opinion exists for scholars who say men shouldn't become gynecologists or obstetricians, people who work with, and that's a different story. I don't agree with that either. I personally would never do it, but I don't think that's a rule of thumb. والسادس النظر للشهادة أو للمعاملة. فيجوز النظر إلى الوجه خاصة. If you're being a witness on nikah or a witness, then you have to look at the face. You're witnessing a marriage. Whose marriage am I witnessing? This man and this woman. Where's the woman? Oh, she's inside. Well, can I know who the woman is? I'm witnessing something here, so you get to look at her. It makes sense. It's a legal testimony. والسابع النظر إلى الأمة عند ابتياعها فيجوز إلى المواضع التي يحتاج إلى تقليبها. And this is of course a very difficult one to talk about. The third seven is to look at if you're buying a slave lady, then you get to look at her before you buy her. That was back in the day when you could buy human beings. This is before things changed, alhamdulillah, drastically in the right direction. Well, to a certain extent in the right direction. So you're allowed to look at whatever you need to look at from her in order to know who she is and if she's healthy enough or to know what you're getting at.
So is this still permissible to buy slaves, or
if you can find them?
No, but I mean, the point of it is to say that it's allowed to look at somebody if you're going to buy them. That means it's okay to buy them.
Yeah. So that's not what this is. What we misunderstand when we read these things. This is not permitting buying or selling slaves. This is saying this was the norm of the time. This is what was happening, right? We have to deal with the social systems that existed in times that we live in. So this was the social system. This is what was happening. She's going to be bought one way or the other. Be bought by a Muslim is better off because she'll get rights and she probably will get at some point her freedom. She's bought by someone else, she may not get any of that. So we're not saying, oh, we encourage buying and selling of slaves. No, that was what's happening, and these are the rulings regarding what's happening. The same thing if we have rulings regarding mortgages and riba. We're not encouraging it. It's just these are the things that we have. These are the rulings regarding how to deal with them. We're not necessarily encouraging you to do this. This is the norm of the time that we have. Okay.
Sorry, another question. So in the second one, it says نظره إلى زوجته أو أمته. So after he buys her, then he can
If he wants to, if he does the aqad of qiran with her. So amatihi, if he married her, like if he gets into the contract of marriage with her. Because she may get into a contract of marriage with someone else.
So basically that's saying the amma is a different definition for both?
Yeah, so for the first one, amatihi al-tazawwajha, yani mulk yaminihi. And here it's just a general. So when you have a slave, you can either marry her, or she can marry someone else, and you can be the wali for her. Like you can be the person who marries her off. So it's a very unique relationship. ولا يصح عقد النكاح إلا بولي وشاهد عدل. And there is not a valid contract of marriage unless there's a wali, there's someone who is marrying off the lady, like a male. وشاهد عدل, and two witnesses. Adil, I mean, they have to be people of certain ethical caliber. They have to have certain status in society for them to be to qualify for that. So the three madhahib all see the wali to be a rukn of arkan al-nikah. I mean, one of the conditions for nikah to be proper for the three madhahib, al-Shafi'i, al-Maliki, and the Hanabila, is that you need a wali. You need someone to be there on behalf of the lady. The Hanafiya don't see that specifically, which makes it much easier to follow the Hanafi ruling in terms of marriage in these countries where family ties are almost always severed and just not. So that is like a permissibility that you'll find for the Hanafis.
Only for the woman that was already married once?
The Hanafis see it also for a bikr, that is baligha, that is old enough to take care of herself. Like she
doesn't need a wali, she just needs the two witnesses.
Yeah, just need two witnesses. So the Hanafi, we'll talk about that inshallah when we say the Hanafi madhab specifically, because that'll be a part that we'll focus on because it's very unique to them. But the majority, you need a wali, the lady needs a wali. The wali isn't there to put obstacles in the marriage. He is there to make sure that the man knows that she has family, she has someone behind her. Like he's not just marrying a woman who has no roots and has no, she has family. He's speaking to a man regarding the marriage. Like you're shaking this man's hand that you'll take care of her, you will be a good husband, so you're giving your word to someone here. So this makes men feel a bit more obligated to do right or to do, to be proper to their wives. And it kind of makes the woman feel more supported that her family is there to marry her off. Let's finish reading this, and there's a few things we'll talk about that are important. ويفتقر الولي والشاهدان إلى ستة شرائط. There are six conditions for the wali and the two witnesses that they have to fulfill. Number one, Islam, they have to be Muslims. Number two, they have to بلوغ, they have to be mature of age. والعقل, they have to be sane. حرية, they have to be free. A slave can't do this. With ذكورة, they have to be men. والعدالة, they have to be ethically respected. I mean, they have to have a certain ethical stance or position or situation in society. إلا أنه لا يفتقر نكاح الذمية إلى إسلام الولي. However, when you're marrying a lady who's from Ahl al-Kitab, you're marrying a Jewish or Christian practicing lady, then the wali of her doesn't have to be a Muslim, obviously, because her parents are probably not Muslim, so it can be her father, he doesn't have to be a Muslim. ولا نكاح الأمة إلى عدالة السيدي. And when you're marrying a slave, you don't need her wali to be someone who's respected, because he could be someone who's not, and that's gonna, you don't want that to be the reason that this lady never gets married in her life, even if she's a slave. So this is important. I mean, the wali, the father of the, which is in most cases the father of the lady, one of the six conditions, and these are all the madhahib that accept.
Like the
now we'll come to that in a minute. Give me a minute. So, because generally it's the father. Just keep this, so the concept is inshallah made clear that there are six conditions that they have to fulfill. One of them is adala. Adala means that he has to be someone who is ethically respected within the society. If this is someone who is known to be a drunk or an abuser or someone who lies or cheats, he can't be a wali. And that, if that condition alone was observed, then a lot of the marriages where ladies are forced into bad marriage wouldn't happen. Because who forces his daughter into a horrible marriage except someone who is very low within the community? And he doesn't even qualify to be a wali in the first place. So it's actually moved to someone else. And that's why, وَأَوْلَى الْوُلَاتِ, and to prioritize those who can be wali to a given lady, individual, is الأب, first of all, the father. The father's not there. Or the father doesn't qualify. By not fulfilling one of the six conditions, he's not a Muslim, for example, he's not aqil, he's not sane, he's not free, he's not adil. Like, he's not someone who has that respect in society. He's not someone known to be ethically impeccable and respected. Then you move it to the Jad, to his father, Jad Abul Ab, meaning the paternal grandfather.
The Qura is male?
Yeah.
And that's for the
Wali, and for the Shahid-e Adil.
Witness, you can have two instead of the one?
You can have two instead of the one.
Two girls instead of one.
There's a difference of opinion even today. Like, you can have, but it's just better to stick to the to two men. Ahsan. It's just better. ثم الأخ للأبي والأم, and then a full brother if those two guys aren't around or they don't qualify. ثم الأخ للأب, and then the paternal brother. ثم ابن الأخ للأب والأم, then the full nephew. ثم ابن الأخي للأب, then the paternal nephew. And it's almost the same عصبة. Remember? The same thing of عصبة, almost exactly the same. ثم العم, and then the uncle. ثم ابنه, and then his son, the cousin. على هذا الترتيب, in that sequence specifically. فإذا عدمت العصبات, if there's none of these guys, none of the عصبات, none of these universal inheritors who can do this, فالمولى المعتق, then look for the slave owner of that family who granted them freedom, if he's available, if this family had slavery in it at some point. ثم عصباته, and then all those who are related to him if he's not around. ثم الحاكم, if none of that, let's say you come from a family that didn't have slavery, and the lady doesn't have a father, doesn't have a grandfather, doesn't have a full brother, doesn't have a paternal brother, doesn't have a full nephew, doesn't have a paternal nephew, doesn't have an uncle or a cousin, then it goes to the hakim. ثم الحاكم, then the ruler or the judge can do it. So if a lady is living here and there's no one, there's nobody, she can go to a judge and the judge can marry her off. Right? So that's and that happens a lot, by the way, more than you think. Yeah, court can do it, and they do it all the time. وَلَا يَجُوزُ أَن يُصَرِّحَ بِخِطْبَةِ مُعْتَدَّةٍ. It's not permissible for you to verbalize and formally express that you want to marry a lady who's in her iddah, meaning a lady who's in that period after she gets divorced or after her husband passes away, where she shouldn't marry. You shouldn't verbalize or make it formal. وَيَجُوزُ أَن يُعَرِّضَ لَهَا. But you can hint to it. It's permissible for you to make a hint that you're interested in this person during that period, but you can't initiate any form of marriage or engagement during that time.
A specific length of time?
4 months.
Yes, 4 months and 10 days, and ثلاثة قروء for the lady who's divorced, which is three cycles of her menstrual period.
By talking about wali, what do we need? What would he do? The permission or just being there?
So we'll come to that in a moment, inshallah. وَيَنْكِحَهَا بَعْدَ انْقِضَاءِ عِدَّتِهَا. He can hint to marrying a lady in that period, and then he can marry her after her iddah is done. Okay, وَالنِّسَاءُ عَلَىٰ ضَرْبَيْنِ. There are two types of ladies in terms of marriage. ثَيِّبَاتٍ وَأَبْكَارٍ. Those who are married before, and those who are not married yet, have never been married before, abkar, bikr. فالبكر يجوز للأبي والجد إجبارها على النكاح. It is permissible for the bikr, for the father or the grandfather specifically, to marry her off even if she's not okay with it. And this is the Shafi'i, Maliki, and Hanbali position. Abu Hanifa, the Hanafiya, and Imam al-Auza'i, and a number of the Tabi'een don't side by this at all. And today, even the Madhahib, the Shafi'iyya today, don't side with this today. So this was the prominent position for the first maybe 700 years for those three madhahib. And then even today, even the Hanabila today and the Malikiya today, they don't side with this position. Well, why was it acceptable to begin with? You want to say something?
Yeah. Wasn't there a clear hadith that mentioned that her consent is required?
Yes, yes.
Silence is her consent, so therefore she voiced her.
Yep, opinion. Yeah, and they would take that as they would take that as recommendations. They didn't. So that's how they. And that's why today this is all changed, because of the clear-cut evidence that they actually went against what the Prophet ﷺ taught. Why did they do it? What was the reason? Well, the reason was very simple. It is unheard of that a father would marry his bikr daughter, his unwedded daughter, to someone that he didn't trust was going to take care of her. Meaning, fathers are the people who are going to look out for their daughters the most, look out for their best interest. So they didn't feel that this was going to jeopardize or compromise the well-being of daughters, because who's doing it? It's the father. Who's going to care for this person more than her own father, right? So that was the idea behind it. Now, throughout history, that proved not to be the case at all. That a lot of fathers and grandfathers don't mind marrying off their daughters just to make their own personal gain or financial gain, not caring about those people at all. And thus, this was reconsidered. And then, of course, like Brother Emmanuel said, the Prophet said word for word in a hadith narrated by Imam Muslim and Bukhari, "الثيب أحق بنفسها من وليها." The pre-married woman or woman who had married before, she can do whatever she wants with herself. The wali doesn't have to be a part of this at all. والبكر يستأمر وإذنها صماتها or صماتها. And the bikr who hasn't married, she has to be asked if she's okay with it. And her idhn is either her saying it or being quiet in bashfulness, meaning she feels ashamed to say that, yes, I'm happy about it. Just out of, you know, back then that's how it was. Or she can say that, yes, I want to marry him. So there's actual clear evidence that that was the case. But the theme of the Ahib, for the longest time, didn't to see that. Especially, it was only for the father and the grandfather. Like, other wali can't do it. Your brother can't do it. Your uncle, your... Yani, they can't do it. It's just the father and the grandfather specifically, because it was seen that the father and grandfather have the best interest of this girl in their minds 100%. So if they think this guy is the right guy to get married, and she may be too young to see it right now, but she'll see it later. That's a different time.
So to summarize the dissent, مُقَدِّمِينَ الْمَلَكِيَ وَشَافَئِيَ وَحَنَابِرَ, they allowed it.
Yeah.
And then those who rejected were the Hanafis, Awzari, and then later Malikiya, Shafi'i, and Hanafi.
Yeah, exactly. So all the later madhab, right now there's not, I don't know, I'm not aware of a scholar that's alive today that will side by this anymore. Like, I don't know. Maybe there is, but I don't know who's certified within his madhab to give fatwa. Wallahu alam. Okay. And I'm telling you the reason behind it. The reason behind it is because it was trusted that the father, I mean, I have a daughter, yani, she's the most important thing to me in my life, 100%. Yani, I'm definitely not going to marry her to someone who's going to mistreat her. 100%, I'm not going to do that. So, yani, I know best. I know what's best for her. So if I make a choice for her, I'm definitely making a choice that's in her best interest. And that's why they allowed this at a certain time. Now, in terms of what does the wali do? The wali does is that he just facilitates the marriage and rejects the man if he sees good reason for it. So that's what the wali does. So he facilitates this marriage, in terms of that he is the person who the young man comes to, and he is the guy who asks his daughter, and he helps negotiate the contract if there's any conditions that she wants or he wants for his daughter, and he gets to reject the guy if he feels the guy is not proper. Meaning, if he feels like his ethics aren't there, his deen isn't there, he's not of the same social status, meaning he won't be able to treat her the way that she's used to be treated. Like, if you're getting someone, so you're the father, and a guy comes asking for your daughter. Now, he has money, and he prays in the masjid. But you know this family, how they treat women. You know that they're very, you don't like how they treat women. You don't like how his dad and how his family speak to their own wives. You don't like how they view women in their family. You know that maybe a few brothers and tend to hit women, or they have that as something that they don't see as a big deal in their family. Then you get to reject this. It's like, I don't think you're kafu. I don't think you're an equivalent, a social equivalent to my daughter. Not that we're better than you. We're just from different demographics, which is very different. An important aspect of marriage is not just that we're equivalent financially, meaning we come from similar backgrounds, we can, I can take care of you financially, and that ethically and religiously we're similar, and that we're attracted to one another. There's also the social equivalence, which is called kafa'a. That's a different thing. This has nothing to do with me being better than you or you being better than me. Based on your cultural background, there are certain things that you enjoy and you're used to and you're accustomed to and you expect that other cultures don't have that. And these different small differences can cause a lot of strains in marriage and can make marriage very different. When you marry outside of your cultural background, be ready. Be ready for a very rocky ride. It's going to be very difficult. You're going to find a lot of... It will be a struggle in terms of how you're going to go through it, because you guys have such different expectations. You come home at 4 o'clock, you're expecting to eat. And she's like, no, I wait for you to come to... We cook together. Are you right or is she right? Who's right? No one's right, really. There's no right and wrong here. It's just whatever you're used to, whatever you're accustomed to. Now, she's accustomed to one thing, accustomed to something else. If there's not clear understanding, you guys it can be really, really difficult to get married. That's why the wali is there to see all these things, that the lady who's saying, no, I like him, he's khaluq, he has all the right stuff, she'll miss that, and then he'll say, no, he's not right for you. He's not right. So he gets to reject. Does she get to appeal? Yeah, she gets to appeal. She gets to appeal. And if he can't, if the father can't prove his point, that that guy is not right, can't give a clear explanation of why, then he is removed, his adala is removed, and then the grandfather can marry her. Or if not the grandfather, the brother, or the, and so on. And she can go to the judge at the end if her family is rejecting this guy for no reason. Because sometimes he's rejected for his color. Right? He's dark-skinned, and they're not, and they don't like dark-skinned people. They're just bluntly racist. And when you ask the father, he says, I don't marry to someone who looks like that. Is that an acceptable reason? No, so she can appeal that. The Hanafiya, see, that's the beauty of the Hanafi madhab, because she doesn't need to. She doesn't need a wali. She'll bring one, but she doesn't need one. She can just marry herself to
what about the point of you have to listen to your parents?
Well, it comes to that, what I'm explaining. Does he have an argument that is proper?
Yeah, like the parents say, okay, he's darker, and she's like, no.
That's not a proper reasoning. Like, if I were to tell my daughter the reason I'm not going to marry, because I know that he'll beat you. I know, I've seen him get angry, I've seen his temper, and I know what he's, his family, and he will hurt you. He will hurt you. So no, I'm not going to marry you to him. That's a strong, valid argument. But I'm like, oh, he's really dark-skinned, and I don't want my grandchildren to be a certain color. That is a completely unacceptable argument, and then that can be refuted almost immediately, and you can move on to another wali.
I was just going to say, Hanafi, just to make sure. So, the wali is required, but what do you think? Is it recommended?
Yeah, it's recommended, but you don't need it. Yeah.
But then, isn't that going to cause there to be like tension between them?
Yeah, 100%.
But then, wouldn't that go like, well, you're not treating your parents?
Nope. They don't get to. So, birr al-wali then has nothing to do with your choices in life. It has to do with your choices regarding them in life and their choices in life. Like, your birr for walidayk is to make sure that they're not hungry, they're not cold, they're not homeless, they're not sick without you attending to their wounds. And that's what your birr is. What you study, where you live, what car you, none of their business. There's no birr there. They can't tell you, wallah, ita'aq, unless you live in London. No, I can live wherever I want to live, it's depending on where I get a job. But I will always support you. Like, my birr is regarding their well-being, not regarding your life choices. Unless you make a life choice that is haram, right? Then it changes. Like, they can use birr. If you're going to say, I'm not going to pray anymore, or I'm going to marry someone who's not a Muslim or not Ahl Kitab, I'm going to marry someone who's from a different. Then you can hold them to that. But generally speaking, you like someone, you want to marry a lady, she has all the right stuff, and your dad looks at her and your mother's like, I don't like her. Baghdab alik if you marry her, I won't speak to you. Yeah, but why? Heck, I don't like her. Why? Heck, I just don't like her. No, why? What's the reason? I'm telling you, she has a good religion, she has a nice family, she's, what's wrong with her, and I'll listen. No, I just don't like them. Meaning it's personal, meaning she's serving her personal agenda. Your mother doesn't like her mother, they always not liked each other, and she's gonna punish that lady by not letting you marry the girl. No, you can do what you want then. But you have to think about the consequences of doing that. It's not about birr now, it's about social consequences. You marry a lady that your mother hates, good luck. That's all I'm gonna say. Just good luck. Okay. والثيب لا يجوز تزويجها إلا بعد بلوغها وإذنها. As far as the thayyib, you cannot marry her off unless she is unless it's her, unless she is informed and it is her decision. Like, she has to give permission for this to actually happen. And that's for all form of that. So it's just the issue for Bikr. Just if she was unmarried and she's young, that the father or the grandfather for the early Shafi'i, Hanabi al-Maliki, would allow him to marry her without asking her. They are off. And this happened a lot, and there was really no problems for it. The custom for it is pretty simple. I'll give an example just to explain this point, because the father will tell the daughter, she's sitting there, she's 18, you're married, Allah fulan ija today asking for you, and I accepted, right? I accepted to marry her. And she starts to giggle, and she's all happy, because she's like, whatever you want, Baba, whatever you say is, I'm good with it, if you're okay with it, because that's the type of family that exists. And she's all excited about getting married, and her father chose someone good for her. And you're saying the idea here, it works for the male as well. Used to happen all the time. The same family, the man will come and say, "Wallah ya Flan, today I went and I saw bint Abu Flan for you, and I liked her, and I khatabta lak ya. I initiated engagement." And the guy's all like, "Alhamdulillah, I'm going to get married." So it's just how social systems worked. So when this social system worked, it was fine. And then these social systems completely collapsed in the last 300 years. So all the fuqaha changed the ruling because of the fact that this didn't work anymore. It wasn't, you know, it became more of a human rights issue than it was a family-oriented decision. Anyways, okay.
And wali should be men.
Always a man. Yeah, always a man. It can be women in some situations. It can be a grandmother or a mother if no one else is found, and if she's the matriarch, she's the leader of the family. It is possible, but it's not custom. Okay, when muharramatu bin nassi arba'a asharata. There are 14 ladies that you cannot marry at any point. Number sab'un bin nasab, 7 based on lineage or heritage or relation. Number 1 wa hunna al ummu in alat, the mother, and just keep on going up. Grandmother, great grandmother, just keep on. Wal bintu wa in safalat, and then the daughter, and just keep on going, granddaughter, great granddaughter. Wal ukhtu, and then the sister. Wal khalatu, the maternal aunt. Wal ammatu, the paternal aunt. Wa bintul akhi, wa bintul ukht, and then nieces on both, paternal niece and maternal niece. I don't know if that's proper, but the sibling, the nieces. So those are 7. Wathnatani bil rada', and 2 types of women you can't marry based on breastfeeding. And we'll talk about that, inshallah, breastfeeding more deeper later. Al-umm wal-murdi'ah, so your mother who breastfed you a certain amount at a certain age. Wal-ukhtu min al-rada'ah, and if you have a sister who you and her were breastfed by the same lady, whether it's your mother, her mother, or some other lady. So you guys become siblings and you cannot marry. The rulings regarding that change mean you cannot stare at her or look at her like you do a mahram, but you can't marry her. So you have to treat her like an ajnabi, but you can't to marry her.
So even though you have no genetic relationship,
you can't marry her. Yeah, but you can be a mahram to her for hajj and stuff like that. But there's certain, it's just different. We'll talk about that, inshallah, come time for it.
What about the daughter of the one?
Yeah, and then it'll come. Just give me a second. We'll say in a minute. Wa arba'un bil musahara, and 4 based on marriage, it becomes haram. Zawja, the mother of your wife, you can never marry her. Wa rabibatu idha dakhala bil and if you marry a lady, you cannot marry any of her daughters that aren't from you. Like you marry a lady, she already had daughters. You cannot marry those daughters once you marry the lady, you've actually consummated the marriage. وَزَوْجَةُ الْأَبْ, and your father's wife, you can never marry her. وَزَوْجَةُ الْإِبْن, and your son's wife. So these 4 you can never marry based on marriage. Like this is what led to this was a previous marriage. وَبَاحِدَةٌ مِنْ جِهَةِ الْجَمْعِ, and 1 from the perspective of gathering, of marrying more than one lady. وَهِيَ أُخْتُ الزَّوْجَةِ, you cannot marry the sister of your wife with you're still married to her sister. You can't marry 2 sisters. So I marry this lady, I can marry 3 others, I just can't marry her sister. وَلَا يَجْمَعُ بَيْنَ الْمَرْأَةِ وَعَمَّتِهَا, and I can't marry her aunts either. So I've married this lady, I can't marry her sisters, and I can't marry her aunts either at the same time. I can't have them at the same time as my wives. وَلَا بَيْنَ الْمَرْأَةِ وَخَالَتِهَا, maternal aunts. So I can't, if I divorce her, I can marry her sister or her aunt, but I cannot marry, if I'm married to her, I cannot marry her sister at the same time or her paternal or maternal aunt at the same time. وَيَحْرُمُ مِنَ الرَّضَاعِ مَا يَحْرُمُ مِنَ النَّسَبِ, and if you are, whoever is haram for you to marry through breastfeeding, it's the same thing will apply to her that applies to nasab. So if I can't marry this lady because my sister in Rada'a, I can't marry any of her descendants. I can't marry her daughters. Is that understood? So I can't marry this lady, because she's my mother in Rada'a. I can't marry her sisters. So this changes the whole dynamic altogether. So يَحْرُمُ مِنْ رَضَاعِ مَا يَحْرُمُ مِنَ النَّسَبِ. Does that answer your question? Because that, okay. Now we'll just read this one and then we'll stop. وَتُرَدُّ الْمَرْأَةُ بِخَمْسَةِ عُيُوبِ. There are 5 deformities that if are you discover on the night of marriage, mean they weren't disclosed to you, and they were hidden and concealed and weren't disclosed to you, this marriage can be annulled. Like you can annul the marriage. Bil junoon, if she's insane, if she turns out to be like crazy, like mentally, extremely mentally ill, with a very clear diagnosis of schizophrenia or bipolar or something very, very clear, this has to be disclosed within the term of khutbah, that she has this, or if she's mentally challenged. but you know, the way that you got married, but you didn't talk much. You just sat there, you looked at her, she smiled at you, you smiled at her. You thought she was sane, then you married her and she stood out, she's not there. Yeah, no one told you about that. And if they told you about that and you're happy with it, good for you. But if not, then you can annul the marriage. وَالْجُثَامِ وَالْبَرَصِ وَالْرَتْقِ وَالْقَرَنِ. And these are all diseases that words for diseases that existed at the time. So Juthaam is a skin disease that is concealed. Al-Baras is a skin disease that is based on discoloration of the skin. Ratq is for her not for there not to be a place for you to actually consummate the marriage. I mean, she doesn't have a full genitalia as a woman. Well, qarani, the same thing. It's just a different type of. So ratq and qarani are the same thing, basically. These aren't important. What's important is if there's a concealed, this is what they agree to. If there's a concealed deformity within the body that would affect the man's ability to have children, to have intercourse, or affect his attractiveness to the lady, this has to be disclosed from her, because this affects how the marriage will work. وَيُرَدُّ رَجُلْ بِخَمْسَةْ عُيُوبٍ. And the man, well, she can also annul the marriage if she finds five deformities in the man. بِالْجُنُونِ, if he's insane, or if he's extremely mentally ill. وَالْجُثَامِ, the same thing, a skin disease. وَالْبَرَصِ, the same thing. وَالْجَبِّ وَالْعُنَّ. الْجَبِّ, if he doesn't have genitalia. Like, it turns out he doesn't have anything down there, or it's not it's chopped off or something like that. وَالْعُنَّ, meaning he has no need for women. He just got married for the, because people told him he could get married, and he doesn't want to keep on having this conversation with people every day. So he got married to this lady, and he's like, look, I have no interest in you at all. And he just has no attraction to her. These are things that are today more important to talk about than before, because you have there's men who have homosexual tendencies and they don't want to practice homosexuality because it's always haram, but they also have to answer that question, well, why aren't you married now? You're 26 and you're 29, you're 32 and you're 50. Why aren't you married now? So he just marries so he doesn't have to do this altogether. That's not proper. You have to disclose that to the woman, that you don't have a sexual attraction. Whether it's physiological or it's psychological, you have to disclose that, or the woman can ask to annul the marriage. Yeah. And we'll talk about that a bit more, inshallah. Next time, subhanAllah, bihamdika, shayna, la ilaha illa anta, astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, Muhammad wa alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Jazakumullahu khair. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين اللهم صل وسلم وبارك على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيبنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين وبعد. So we're still in Kitab al-Nikah. We're talking about marriage and everything that is associated with marriage. This is a very important chapter within the book. There are a lot of differences of opinions regarding certain things. When we come to talk today, we'll start talking about divorce a bit. Divorce is going to be very difficult because there's so many differences of opinions on divorce. I will pick and choose what I'm going to talk about comparatively in fiqh, and other things I'll just leave as is. I'll just tell you what I think is the best way to do it, and we'll just leave it until we talk about a different, because other mutun will be easier, the earlier parts will be easier because we did a lot of comparative there, and then we can do comparative when we're doing like the Hanbali madhab or Hanafi. We can do comparative within, we don't have to do all the comparative in the Shafi'i one, which will take us literally forever to finish. So we start today with talking about the dowry or mahr. وَيُسْتَحَبُّ يَقُولُ الْإِمَامُ أَبُو شُجَاعٌ وَيُسْتَحَبُّ تَسْمِيَةُ الْمَهْرِ فِي النِّكَاحِ. And it is recommended that you specify what the mahr is or how much it is when on the contract of marriage. It is recommended. فَإِنْ لَمْ يُسَمَّ, but if it's not specified, صَحَّ الْعَقْدِ, the actual marriage contract is proper, is valid. It's not invalid because you didn't specify the amount of the dowry. ووجب المهر بثلاثة أشياء. And the mahr becomes wajib with one of three things happening. أن يفرضه الزوج على نفسه, for the man to say, I am now obligated to pay you this much, meaning gives it an amount and he obligates himself. It becomes wajib. أو يفرضه الحاكم, or for the judge to specify it or to make it obligatory. أو يدخل بها, or for you to consummate the marriage. So and you guys go into your home and you live together, you sleep together, then from that moment on the mahr. فَيَجِبُ مَهْرُ الْمِثْلِ, and the mahr of al-mithl. Now this is a very important phrase, مَهْرُ الْمِثْلِ. You'll hear it a lot in Kutub al-Fiqh. So every part of the world, there is a norm for mahr. I remember when my wife, when I got married to my wife, the mahr of al-mithl was around 100,000 lira, which is, what was it? Maybe $2,000 or less than that, something like that. So it's pretty small amount. That was the mahr al-mithl. So you can either give her more or give her less, but if you don't give a number, then you're going to pay mahr al-mithl. Right? If you don't give, if you don't specify a number, then what she is owed is the mahr of the norm of the place and time that she is living in. You'll be, what is the average of mahr in this place? This is the average, this is what usually people get, this is what usually girls are taking, that's what you owe her. So if you don't specify the mahr, the aqd is, the marriage contract is still valid, but you owe her mahr al-mithl. Mahr al-mithl. And it becomes obligatory once you obligate it upon yourself, or the judge and he obligates you, meaning he signs the contract, or you actually marry her, you guys live together, then you owe her a mahr al-mithl. All right. وليس لأقل الصداق ولا لأكثره حد. And there is no limit for how little the mahr can be or how much the mahr can be. It can be anything at all. Now, we are recommended not to make it too expensive. That is the recommended thing within our within Islam. But it's not problematic if someone specifies upon himself $2 million mahr for his wife. That's his choice, right? The problem becomes when we raise the bar for marriage in general, and that ruins societies and it ruins communities when you start making the mahr higher than what the average Muslim young man can afford within his life.
Does the mahr have to be monetary value?
No. وَيَجُوزُ أَنْ يَتَزَوَّجَهَا عَلَى مَنْفَعَةٍ مَعْلُومَةٍ. And it's permissible for a man to marry a woman based on a manfa, based on an act of a service. So it can be based on a service. It could be a thing, an asset, or it could be a service. It doesn't have to be money, but it's mostly... So for example, the man who married during the time of the Prophet ﷺ, he married a lady with the service of teaching her a certain amount of the Qur'an that he had learned that she did not have. So the mahr was that he was obligated to teach her that amount. So he was going to make sure that she knew it. Okay, so this is a manfa, or it could be any service of any sort, whatever you guys agree to, basically. Or it could be an asset. The mahr is this, car or that house, or it's all good. So it could be a monetary value, it could be a service. And a service is acceptable in marriages as well. As long as both parties are okay with it, whatever. But there has to be a mahr. There has to be some dowry, some amount of dowry. There has to be some service or asset that the man is going to offer the wife as a gesture of respect, as a gesture of commitment. We feel pain in our pockets as men. That's where we feel the pain. So once you put us to pay or to offer an asset that, or offer a service, that's where we show commitment to things. And that's the concept. And it's also a hadiyah, it's a gift that the lady feels she feels valued by. You're not buying her. Obviously, that's not what was happening. I think this is a gift offered to her. The parents should not take any of it at all. You don't offer the father any money. If the father's asking for money, then you should report that to elders in the community to go and see what that's about. Because the father should not be taking anything from the husband at all. You find that in certain parts of the world. I've seen that more than once. وَيَسْقُطُ بِالطَّلَاقِ قَبْلَ الدُّخُولِ بِهَا نِصْفُ الْمَهْرِ. If you divorce your wife before you actually consummate the marriage. So you wrote your marriage contract and you guys are going to stay engaged until maybe the end of the year, and that's when you're going to get married. So if in that period, before you actually sleep with her, if you divorce her, you owe her half the mahr. You owe her half the mahr. Now the mahr today is divided into something called muqaddam and mu'akhar. Have you heard that before? What is it in English? Is there a name, wording for it?
It's kind of like early payment or on the spot payment and then late payment.
Yeah. So muqaddam usually means she's going to get it from you before you guys enter your home, your marriage, marital home. And mu'akhar means that you will pay her this later on in life. Now it's important to understand the following. That you owe her the mahr, whether you divorce her or not. You're married to her, so you owe her the full amount of mahr. You'll find this in marriage contracts written. You'll find muqaddamuhu, like this, will be written like this in Arabic. And muakharuhu. And here they'll put maybe, $2,000. And here, they'll put $40,000. Now the poor man doesn't understand that he owes her $42,000 in his life. He owes her that money. That's her right. That's her God-given right. So you pay her this now, but this is going to be paid within your life. And if you don't pay it, it's considered a debt and it's taken out of your inheritance for your wife before anyone touches the inheritance. You owe her this, and you should pay her during your life her mahr. You could say, well, I've gifted her so many things. I've bought her clothes. No. Mahr has to be specified that this is mahr. And it cannot be a substitution of a monthly of the monthly payment that you owe her in terms of food and clothing and nafaqah. Because you owe your wife nafaqah, you owe her a certain amount of money every month for herself. If she's not working and she's taking care of the family and the kids, you owe her a certain amount of money. It's called nafaqah. It's a percentage of what you make. It's not a fixed amount, it's a percentage of what you make. That can't be seen as a part of the mahr. A mahr, you're going to be putting away money to pay her this. So don't write crazy big numbers at the end. Don't do that. And if you do, make sure that when you're giving your wife, you know, gifts and stuff like that, that you say this is a part of the mahr. So that you don't end up, a man came in, a young guy almost had a heart attack. He said, I just gave her a $35,000 car. And I didn't tell her it was mahr. And he's like, I owe her $25,000 or $30,000 mahr. And he's like pulling his hair out of his head. I'm like, okay, then go tell her I want this to be mahr and see if she's okay with that. And he did, and she said it's okay. So that's, because you have to pay her mahr. A lot of men say, oh, she'll forgive me. No. I am very, very heavily against the concept of a lady forgiving mahr without carrying the money in her hands first. Meaning, she can forgive you in her mahr, but make sure that you put the 40K in her hands first, and then she can forgive you. I guarantee you that 101% of all women who take their mahr will not return the full amount. 100% of them will not return the full amount. They'll return a certain amount of it. Like if they want to forgive you, give her the 40K, and then let her give it back in forgiveness. I guarantee you she'll give 38 or 37 or 35. She will not give 40 back. It's her right. It's her God-given right. Don't take away her right by shaming her or making her feel embarrassed because, you know, we're living together. You owe her this. You shouldn't have written it if you're not ready to pay it. This is what you owe her. It's not based on divorce. This is based on just living with her. You owe her that money. And make sure that you have some witnesses when she takes the money so that it's signed up, that you pay her mahr. So she can't come back. Now here in this country, there's no mahr anyway on the contracts, so it doesn't matter. It's just your dhamir, it's just your conscience that will hold you. But in other countries, it becomes a problem because...
Here is something. When you go to the city, you have to register a marriage in the...
Yeah. Yeah, but there's no mahr in the registration process.
Yeah, not in the city, but...
Yeah, so the lady can't ask you for her mahr legally. When you divorce her in this country, but other countries, no, she can ask for it. So you have to make sure that you pay the mu'akhar. Don't make the mu'akhar too big. Don't make it a large number. It's important that's understood. That you owe her that. It has nothing to do with the nafaqah. It's nothing to do with taking care of the family and the kids in the house. That's her money. That is away from the money that you owe her every month just to live by. It's her mahr. So you have to put away. You have to start putting away money. It's like a student loan. It's like a loan. You owe her. You're not ready to pay this loan. You make what, $2,000 a month, and you have nothing. Don't write $40,000 on yourself. How are you gonna pay that off? That's equivalent to your student loan. Take you all your life to do it. So it's not a good idea. And then if you don't, and you buy a house using maybe $35,000, and you guys get divorced, she's gonna take it. You owe her that place. You use her money. That's her money. Because once you have it, a debt is paid up front, right? Before you do anything else, before you buy houses or cars, you have to pay your debt. This is debt. That's why when your mahr is divided, the second part of the mahr is debt that you owe your wife. I think it's important to think. That's why we have to bring down the numbers a bit. You have to be a bit more merciful. You're not guaranteeing the rights of your daughter by making the man pay a lot. Actually, you're making him resent you and resent her, knowing that his presence wasn't worthy enough for marriage. You had to put a slap, a 40K policy on him in order for you to... Actually, the less you make the man pay in mahr, the more open he is to... the more loving he'll be, inshallah. And if he's a good person, that's what you'll get. Okay. وَالْوَلِيمَةُ عَلَى الْعُرْسِ مُسْتَحَبَّةٌ And having food for people, feeding people on the day of your wedding is recommended. مُسْتَحَبَّ So for all four schools of thought, it's mustahab only for the Zahiriya, or only Ibn Hazm said it's wajib. Ibn Hazm rahmatullah alayhi said it was wajib, you have to do it because of the hadith that exists, but everyone else said it's mustahab. Just feed, it's a good thing, and even if you just feed your family, if just your family and her family, that's enough. But it's mustahab to feed as many people as possible to celebrate the actual marriage. The lady will appreciate that, her family will appreciate that, and it's a nice feeling to do that. وَالْإِجَابَةُ إِلَيْهَا وَاجِبَةُ إِلَّا مِنْ عُذْرٍ And if you are asked to go to a walima, it's wajib for you to attend. As a Muslim, if you're asked to attend a wedding, it's wajib unless you have excuse. unless you have a good excuse that way, something's booked or something like that. But if you're asked to go to a wedding, go to a wedding, because this is promoting marriage and encouraging marriage, and everyone, yeah, it's a good thing to do. I personally fall short of these things all the time. I rarely go to marriage. I hate going to weddings. Unless you know the wedding is something haram's having in it, unless it's a wedding that there's a lot of, if there's drinking or something like that, you don't have to go. But if it's a wedding, good Muslim people getting married, then you should attend, unless you have an excuse that day, then that's a different story. وَالتَّسْوِيَةُ فِي الْقَسْمِ بَيْنَ الزَّوْجَاتِ وَاجِبَةِ. And equality, if you're married to more than one woman, in how much money you spend on them is wajibah. That is, you cannot marry two women and spend on one more than you spend on the other. If you do marry more than one, I don't think any of you will have this problem in their lives, but if you do, then you have to spend equal amounts of money on both households and on both of your wives. وَلَا يَدْخُلُ عَلَى غَيْرِ الْمَقْسُومِ لَهَا لِغَيْرِ حَاجَةٍ. And if it's your first wife's night, then you should not enter the house of the second wife unless there's a hajj, unless there's a necessity, a need. Out of respect to her, you don't go to the other wife's house. وَإِذَا رَادَ السَّفَرَ أَقْرَعَ بَيْنَهُنَّ وَخَرَجَ بِالَّتِي تَخْرُجُ لَهَا الْقُرْعَ. And if you are going to travel, then you just, قُرْعَ meaning just based on luck. You just flip a coin and take whoever it comes out for. So unless you're someone who always is traveling, in that case, then you do it by sequence. She went with me the first time, she'll with me. If you can't take both, this is saying that if you go and you're not capable of taking all your wives with you, then you take one. Next time, you take the other one. So you don't take the same one every time. That's not fair. Okay. So it's all based on equality and fairness when you're married to more than one woman. And you have to be someone who has enough money. This is one of the conditions of marrying more than one woman. That you have to have, if I'm spending $10,000 a month on this household, and I'm going to marry another woman, it can't just be $5,000 and $5,000. No, this 10 has to stay. I have to be wealthy enough to, I now have a new 10. Okay, I'm making more money, I have an extra $10,000 I'll spend on this new household. It has to be equal, and I cannot take away from the money that I'm spending on the first household. That's a very important point in marrying more than one woman. So you have to be someone who is who is wealthy. But let's say you're paying only $500 a month on this household, and you have an extra $500, it's fine, but that means you're pretty poor. And if the lady is willing to marry you anyway and her family is, that's their choice. Some people live, some people don't care. Money is not a problem, that's how they live, especially if you go to the to Bedouin areas where they live. They don't have money at all, they have very little provision. And usually the men are married to three or four women, and everyone is pretty standard of how things run. They just, whatever extra they have, they marry another, as long as they have enough extra in terms of equality, paying the same amount for each household.
I was going to say, in terms of, say you are married to your first wife, and you want to marry a second, does your first wife have to be honorary?
She has to know. She doesn't have to agree. She has to know. In order for marriage to be proper in Islam, you have to do i'lan. It's one of the arkan. You have to, people have to know about it. Now, who has to know about it? Those who are close to you. Who's closer to you than your own wife? If she doesn't know about it, then how is this? Not everyone has to know about it. I don't have to know who's every person in London who's, if they're married or not. That's not my. But your vicinity, your surroundings, of people, your acquaintances, they all have to know. So a man who's married to another woman and his first wife doesn't even know about it, that's problematic. Now, most scholars don't take that position, but it's a more modern position that I am very, very, I take very seriously because this is actually a clear, breach of some of the basic concepts of marriage in Islam, because people should know about it. Now, she doesn't have to agree to it. Of course, she's not going to agree to it. Most women don't want to agree to it. Some will. But unless she conditions on you, on the contract of your marriage with her, that she will not have a second wife, there would be no second wives, then she can't really do anything to hold you accountable. If she does, then you can't marry another wife. And if you are, then usually there's a penalty, or you have to divorce her. There has to be something done if you decide to marry another woman. But if not, then no. But the thing is, why would you want to, marrying another woman without the consent or the acceptance, even if it's not like open-hearted acceptance of your wife, is not recommended. It ruins families. You can ruin your life with your first wife, and if you have kids with her, which is usually this case here. Usually it's men who are going through a midlife crisis who decide they want to get up and marry another woman, and they already have like four or five kids. Now you could destroy this household. So it's important that that this is discussed, and if it's not proper, this is a huge issue to talk about. Today, men are no longer, it's frowned upon, even in Muslim societies, for men to marry more than one woman. But on the same, on the other hand, it's quite difficult for men, for all men, to stay married to only one woman throughout their lives. A lot of men have, they have those needs to marry more than one, and for them not to be permitted to do it even properly and through the halal way is actually quite problematic. So if you are someone who feels that they may want to marry another woman in their life, make sure that's something you bring up when you're marrying your first wife, that I'm open to that. Are you open to that? Is this a deal breaker? You'll be surprised. It's not a deal breaker to all of them. Yes, many of them, especially Western Muslims, and they won't be open to it. But others, we find it quite different. Depends on the place you're coming from in the world. Anyways, I don't want to get into the details of all that, but just the basic fiqh of it is important, because that's a philosophical. And if my wife sees this, then I want to go home and I want to be able to sleep in my house tonight. So, okay. وَإِذَا تَزَوَّجَ جَدِيدَةً خَصَّهَا بِسَبْعِ لَيَالٍ إِنْ كَانَتْ بِكْرًا وَبِثَلَاثٍ إِنْ كَانَتْ ثَيِّبًا. If you do marry a new woman or another woman, then you, if she's a virgin, maybe she was never married before, you owe her 7 nights to be with her and only her. And if she's married before, then you owe her 3. وَإِذَا خَافَ نُشُوزَ الْمَرْأَةِ وَعَضَهَا. Now if there's nushuz. Nushuz is a term that is differed upon among scholars. The majority say that she is disobedient and ma'roof. I mean, she's doing haram things. She's saying something haram, acting in a way haram, but it's not fawahish. She's not doing something, she's not betraying you. Other scholars specify nushuz to be the betrayal, meaning she's starting to look at other men, speak to other men, doing things that are related to her chastity. So if that's what you're fearing, or you're seeing actions that are related to that, either way, wa'adaha, meaning you speak to her with the best of, with the most tender of words, meaning you're very tender in the way that you speak to her, and how you remind her of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You're not allowed in Islam to yell or to verbally abuse your wife ever. If you do that, that can be very problematic. She can get a divorce for that. She can get the judge to divorce her from you, and that's, if that's what you do. So verbal abuse is off the all forms of abuse is off the table. But verbal abuse is held very highly in Islam. You do not say anything that is disrespectful. You do wow. فَإِنْ أَبَتْ, she doesn't listen, إِلَّا النُّشُوز, to continue doing the haram that she's doing, هَجَرَهَا, you stop coming to bed at night. Like you sleep elsewhere. You sleep in a different room or a different bed. فَإِنْ أَقَامَتْ عَلَيْهِ, and she's still persistent on doing that, هَجَرَهَا وَضَرَبَهَا, then you can lightly strike her. And ضَرَب here is, هَجَرَهَا, I mean you don't sleep with her, and the concept of ضَرَب that exists in the Qur'an, and that is talked about, very controversial in the deen, is what you're permitted to do. Now what are the guidelines that we have within the deen regarding that? The Prophet ﷺ said, بِسِوَاك. So you know what a miswak is? The miswak? Yeah, so the miswak. You use a miswak. So it's not a concept, that it's not a beating. Actually, if any lady, or any man, to be honest, in a marriage, presents to a judge, Islam, Muslim judge, of any, and there's a mark of being struck, then not only should she get a divorce, he can go to jail. So either كَسَرَ عَظْمًا أَوْ رَضَّ لَحْمًا, or that is immediately a felony. That's not something you're allowed to do in Islam. A man can't beat his wife black and blue and say, well, I'm doing what the Quran, she did in the shoes. No, that's not how it is. Darb in the Quran is a physical gesture. It is telling your partner that we're coming to the end of the line. The next step is going to be a divorce. We're going to ruin our family. It's a wake of jail. And this is, and of course, the evidence for this is overwhelming within the history of Islam and the books of fiqh. They didn't feel the need to verbalize all that, because this was understood. The Prophet ﷺ was with a miswak. He never did it, ﷺ, but he said, use a miswak. The Quran has dhigth. Dhigth is like if you take some grass, like a bunch of grass, that's what a dhigth is. That's what when Ayyub alayhi salam in the Quran, he swore that he was going to hit his wife if she didn't stop complaining about what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala did to them. He made a yameen. When he got better, he said, I made a yameen that if I got better, I would, for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells him, take a dhigth, take some grass, and khalas, and that's the end of it. So it's not a punishment. It's more of a gesture of a wake up call, that you have to change. it became physical for a moment, and the wife now is understanding that we're on a different, things are going need to change quickly. So it's not about punishment, and it's not giving you access to actually harm your wife in any way. She can, again, any mark of being struck or being hit, she can take that to a judge, and you can end up going to jail, and she gets her divorce, and she gets compensation as well. And that's Islamically speaking. It has to be that. Nushuz. It has to be disobedience and haram for some scholars, and betrayal, which is the prominent position that I take here, that it has to be something regarding betrayal or fahisha. And she's trying to do something, and she's starting to ruin the family in a way that's unfixable. Okay. وَيَسْقُطُ بِالنُّشُوزِ قَسْمُهَا وَنَفَقَتُهَا. And if she continues to do nushuz, that she don't owe her the nafaqa, to give her money every month for herself. Of course, for the family and the house you do, but for herself you don't. And qasmuha, meaning the nights that you spend with her, you don't have to do it equally anymore if you're married to more than one woman. وَالْخُلْعُ جَائِزٌ عَلَىٰ عِوَضٍ مَعْلُومٍ. الْخُلْعُ is when we end marriage, when the lady asks for divorce, asks for this marriage to end. And she wants to be separated from her husband. She wants a divorce to happen, but not that husband initiating it. She wants to initiate it. She wants to end it. عِوَضٍ مَعْلُومٍ, meaning she can offer the husband some compensation. She can tell him, I don't want the mahr, just let me go. She can do that. Or she can say, here, I have this much money, take this money and just leave me. I don't want to be married to you anymore. So she can do that. وَتَمْلِكُ بِهِ الْمَرْأَةُ نَفْسَهَا وَلَا رَجْعَةَ لَهُ عَلَيْهَا إِلَّا بِنِكَاحٍ جَدِيدٍ. And from that moment, if it happens, he cannot ask her to come back to be his wife anymore. See, if a man divorces his wife, there's a period that he can ask her to come back, and she has to come back to the marriage again. And we'll talk about that in a while. But when she does khula, she's not required to come. To go back. They're completely separated, and they can only be married again بِنِكَاحٍ جَدِيدٍ. If they initiate a completely new marriage, when he comes, he brings in the witnesses, his family, they write a new marriage with a new mahr, with a new everything. It has to be as if they weren't married before, right? But khalas, once the khula happens, they are completely separated. There's no grace period where we can ask her to come back. Yeah.
Does she have to marry somebody else and
no.
get rid of them first?
No.
It's only in the regular.
Yeah, only in the regular. After the third tatliqa. Yeah. We are using khul'u fi al-tuhri wa fi al-yes.
In case of khula, is optional to withdraw from mahr or
for khula specifically, that's okay. For khul'a.
Yeah, she has to.
No, she doesn't have to, but she can if she wants to. She can offer something else. She can tell. She can say, I want to be completely separated and divorced from you. You can keep the kid. Right? She can give up her right in having kids. She can say, here, you can have this car, you can have this house, whatever. Like, something they agree to. Or it could be with no agreement, so I just want to be separated. So he's like, all right, fine, go. خلاص, it's خلع. It's over, right? وَيَجُوزُ الْخُلْعُ فِي الطُّهْرِ وَفِي الْحَيْضِ. And it's permissible for خلع to happen whether she is in her period or she's not. Because there's a difference in divorce. Divorce has to happen outside of the period.
So my question is, if it's non-revocable, the only reason why we're saying that in this case, even though they can renew the marriage, is that there's also no idda in this case?
No, there is.
There's still
yeah. It's just
that he doesn't have the three chances.
Yeah, exactly. وَلَا يَلْحَقُ الْمُخْتَلِعَةَ الطَّلَاقُ. So he can't do talaq after khula', because once you do khula', you guys are divorced. You can't do talaq after khula'. Khula' is basically talaq. So it doesn't work both ways. وَالطَّلَاقُ ضَرْبَان صَرِيحٌ وَكِنَايَةٌ. There's two ways of talaq. Sarih, direct and clear, and kinaya is figurative. Like this is regarding to what you can say that could cause divorce to happen. And this is where we will spend some time discussing some details. Or I will at least. Because the prominent position for scholars is what we're going to read in the metin here in the text. However, I believe that a lot of circumstances have changed to the point where some of these rulings have changed. And I side by a number of different opinions that aren't officially a part of the madhahib today, but I believe will become very, very soon, based on necessity and based on the change of a lot of circumstances regarding marriage. So back in the day, فَالصَّرِيحُ ثَلَاثَةُ أَلْفَاظُ الطَّلَاقُ وَالْفِرَاقُ وَالسَّرَاحُ وَلَا يَفْتَقِرُ صَرِيحُ الطَّلَاقِ إِلَى النِّيَّةِ. So direct is when you say طَلَّقْتُكِ or سَرَّحْتُكِ أو فَارَقْتُكِ, one of those three words which are clearly طَلَاق. You don't have to have the intention for that to fall, for the scholars. And you don't have to have intention for this to be true. If you say it, she's divorced. You've divorced her the first time. So don't say it, not even joking, because that's for the scholars. Now, I'm going to recite what the text says, and then I'm going to make commentary maybe at the end or maybe next time in terms of what I side with or what I think the prominent opinion, proper opinion regarding this is. But this is what the scholars have said, and this is what is the jumhur of the ulama stand by. Because of the fact that back in the day, writing marriages and writing things and contracts and certifying it with city halls, that wasn't the norm. It was just a man, and two witnesses, the father, the lady, and that was the end of it. Zawajtuka qabiltu, here's the mahr, we're done, we're married. Right? There's nothing else. So it was done based on words, so it'll be end based on words. Today it's done based on writing and contracts and certifying. So I think it should be ended the same way. And we have evidence for that in the Quran as well, that scholars have always kind of not understood literally because of their lack of ability to see the practicality of it. But today it's much clearer to us, especially the beginning of Surah Al-Talaq, for example, where it kind of states a number of things. I will talk about all that. So what I'm reading right now is not necessarily the opinion that I side by, but is what the Shafi'i said. And there are a lot of Shafi'i that are modern today, that are living today, that have a different opinion than that, what the madhab actually states. Well, kinaya, so it's an abstract or figure of speech. كل لفظ يحتمل الطلاق وغيره ويفتقر إلى النية. So every word that could mean طلاق or could mean something else. So it could, like, إلحقي بأهلك, go live with your parents. That could mean that you're divorcing, or it could mean just go live with your parents for a while. It could be any, so this is based on your niyyah. Did you mean to divorce her? Then she's divorced. If you didn't mean to divorce her, then she's not. So your niyyah now, so we're going to have to ask you. You're going to have to be either honest about it or not honest about what you meant when you did it. وَالنِّسَاءُ فِيهِ ضَرْبَانٍ. And there are two situations in terms of talaq regarding women. ضَرْبٌ فِي طَلَاقِهِنَّ سُنَّةٌ وَبِدْعَةٌ. I mean, there's a group of women that when you do talaq, it could be either sunnah or bid'ah. It could be either proper talaq, that the way the Prophet ﷺ taught us, or it could be a bid'ah talaq, a talaq that is improper and wrong. So what are they? وَهُنَّ ذَوَاتُ الْحَيْضِ. The ladies who are menstruating. So ladies who are menstruating, you can either do talaq properly, a sunnah talaq, or you can do talaq improperly, a bid'ah talaq. Like what? فَالسُنَّةُ أَنْ يُوقِعَ الطَّلَاقَ فِي طُهْرٍ غَيْرِ مُجَامِعٍ فِيهِ. So a sunnah is for you to divorce your wife during her time of purity, which is not menstruating, during a time of purity that you did not have relations with her. So she was during her period, so we did not divorce her, and then now she's not in her period anymore. And you have yet to have relations, because you can't have relations with her during her period. Now she does not, you have not had relations and you divorce. And that is sunnah, that's how you do it. If you have relations with her, then you shouldn't do it. And that's what the next. Well, bid'atu, أن يوقع الطلاق في الحيض أو في طهر جامعها فيه. Bid'ah is for you to give talaq when she's in her menstrual period, or she's in nifas, for example, like she just gave birth, she can, or it's in a tuhur, it's in a time of purity that you have had relations with her in. So you slept with her during that time, and then you did talaq the next morning or the next day. That's bid'ah, and you shouldn't, that should not be done. Okay. The talaq still happens, but it's a bid'ah talaq. Meaning the talaq actually occurs, but it's a bid'ah. Meaning you made a mistake and you should go back. You shouldn't have done it. You shouldn't have initiated at the time. But the talaq still happens. Like you divorced her. وَضَرْبٌ لَيْسَ فِي طَلَاقِهِنَّ سُنَّةٌ وَلَا بِدْعَةٌ. There's a type of women where there's no sunnah and bid'ah in their talaq. وَهُنَّ أَرْبَعٌ. There are four types. الصَّغِيرَةُ وَالْآيِسَةُ وَالْحَامِلُ وَالْمُخْتَلِعَةُ الَّتِي لَمْ يَدْخُلْ بِهَا. So all those who don't menstruate, either those who are too young to menstruate, and they used to sometimes marry girls who before they hit puberty, like a year before or 6 months before they hit puberty, or Aisa, she's too old, she's done menstruating, or she's pregnant, or al-mukhtali'a, التي لم يدخل بها, a lady who asked, wants to end the dudkhul' before you actually consummated the marriage. And that, so those ones, there's no bid'ah and sunnah, you can just do talaq anytime that you want to do talaq. Okay. So divorcing a pregnant woman is not haram. It's not bid'ah. It's not recommended, but it's not haram. Yeah, so if you choose to divorce while she's pregnant, that's your choice as well. Yeah. What's really important about understanding talaq is that talaq in Islam is a qarar. It's a decision. It's not a spree of the moment. It's not an emotional reaction. men throughout history, especially in the early Islamic ages, were in much more control of their emotions than men are today. And that is something that is very, very clear when you read a bit of the books and you read fiqh. Men, talaq is in your hand as a man because you are less likely to say anything or look for divorce based on being upset or being angry or after a fight. Women are much more emotional. That may come to their minds more often than men will. Today, that's not the case anymore. Or for most men, that's changing. That's why it's important for you to start observing yourself as a man, that you do not behave in a reactional way emotionally. You get upset and you want to end the marriage. That's not what men do. Men understand that marriage is difficult. That is an institution that takes a lot of work, a lot of effort. You put a lot of time into it. There are ups and downs. She gets angry. Sometimes she's happy. This is not going to affect you as long as she's doing the basic stuff. As long as she's loyal, like we said in the shoes, as long as she's a Muslim or she's a practicing Jew or Christian, meaning she has some belief that she holds on to, and her ethics and chastity are there, then you are good. She's fulfilling the basics. You're not going to divorce her based on other stuff, unless, at least in an emotionally reactional way. You're going to do it if you are, based on a decision. Meaning, we've been trying to make this work for a while, and this is not working. I'm not happy and you're not happy, let's part ways. So, talaq is done in an elegant manner. And that's when you find the Quran always, when it talks about talaq, سَرِّحُهُنَّ سَرَاحًا جَمِيلًا. Do it in an elegant way. اتَّقُوا اللَّهِ. Surah al-Talaq has اتَّقُوا اللَّهِ 4 or 5 times in one page. It's talking about doing it in a way that is elegant, that is respectful, that shows fearfulness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that you're not divorcing her with anger and hatred, and you're not talking about her and her family. She's doing the same about you. It turns into a big mess, and now families have animosity till the day of judgment because of two people who were married and aren't married anymore. That's not how it happens. So men, they divorce based on decisions, based on thinking about things and discussing them and trying to find ways to, to fix it. Didn't work out, we divorce. It's not, she said something, انت طالق, خلاص روحي, you're divorced. That men don't do that. I'm sorry, males may do that, but men don't do that. And that's why talaq was put in the hand of the man, because he wouldn't do it. And if he is doing it, then he's not worthy of that. That's why in certain contracts, the lady can ask for the ismah to be in her hand. She can ask for the talaq to be her choice, not his. And you could agree to that as a man. You can say, yeah, I'm someone who doesn't control his emotions very well. You're much more stable than I am. Here, you keep it. So when I say it, doesn't mean anything anymore. I want a divorce. The talaq doesn't mean anything. She gets to do it. You don't get to do it anymore. Which is permissible. If you know that you're that type of person, that's fine. But
both of them can have the right.
Yeah, but normally speaking, without specification, it's for the man by default. So by default, it's for the man, but the woman can have it as well, if she chooses to have it. But men are supposed to be more stable emotionally. This is not anti-feminist. This is not sexist. If it wasn't for the emotional part of women's lives, and there would be no human race. You don't understand the importance of it until you have a kid. They have an ability to carry these kids and love these kids and put up with these kids and be patient with these kids way more than you do. Like, way more than you do. Like, as a father, you're like 15 minutes and you're good. You're good. Now, the other 23 hours and 45 minutes, I don't know. I did my 15 minutes. I'm good. I don't want to see this kid anymore. Take her away. Please take them away. And then the lady can take them away for all because of that emotional ability. It's what nurtures life. It was to make sure that we can survive as a race. So it's very rude and disrespectful for us as men to mistreat women or divorce them or hold that against them because of their emotional, because it's like, well, she's not making sense, she's not being rational, she's not thinking with her mind. Well, be very thankful she's like that, or else you wouldn't be alive, neither would your kids. So you have to put up with it, and you have to be respectful and mindful of it, and kind of let, because that's how they are. It's just, it's an advantage, and it has its advantages and has its disadvantages. Don't take the good and refuse the bad, take it both good and bad, and that's why it's with you. Because she may get very upset with you one day, and she'll, let her emotions explode, and she wants to divorce you, but you're like, no, I know. She's just, it's okay. I'm not going to let that happen, because I'm much more smart. I'm much more stable emotionally. I have to edit that out. That wasn't what I meant. It's good.
Why do you think that is now? Because men are more emotional. Why do you think that is a thing? Why men are
now?
Nowadays.
Because we're not being raised as men anymore. Like, we're not actually being raised as men. Where you go out of the house and you work, and you fight to survive, and you prove yourself. Now we're being pampered. Your feelings are hurt. Is that a microaggression? Did you feel like someone's in your space? For a man, for a shab, for a young boy, that's what you're going to tell the kid. You're raising a weak generation of men. It's not going to be in anyone's best interest for that to happen. Boys will be boys, right? They'll always have that roughness to them, but it's needed. Again, it has advantages and disadvantages. It's important for the survival of the race. It's to protect the family, to protect you're the protector. It's important. You're going to go make the money. You're going to work. You're going to put up with all the garbage out there to make sure that this family is going to live and survive. And she's going to be that person who can put up with little people around her all day long and love them and give them all, because you need so much love. For kids need love, and kids, first of all, they need someone to always hug them and love them, or else they can't survive. They'll die, and not because of a medical reason, just die off. If they live, it's worse. Have a kid like that live, now you have a serial killer on your hand, in your society. It's actually, so these, the advantages and disadvantages are important for the survival of the race, but we really ruined that, a lot of that, by the way we start to treat one another. Young boys have to be raised with some toughness to them. There has to be that toughness there. You're not seeing it anymore. You're not raising a kid to be cruel or to lack empathy or to lack compassion. You just have to be much more tough, right? And girls do too, by the way. Like, it's important for girls to also grow up with some toughness to them. Maybe not to the same extent of men, but, and you have to, your kid in your life, make sure he works early on. Put him to work. Make him work. Make him get tired. Really understand the value of money, the value of hard work, the value of ethics, the value, how he's supposed to present himself, and how he's supposed to be so confident, how he's supposed to be able to go out there. He has to have that culture of I have to make a living. I have to support people financially. Men have to think like that. Now we're looking at people in their 30s, and they're slobs, sitting around playing video games all day. They don't feel that I have to make any money. No, you guys, you're a breadwinner. Go work, go hunt, go protect. And she's a family bearer. She takes care of families. She holds on to the house. She keeps the house functioning. She keeps people together. She keeps the family close. You have to raise kids, boys and girls, with those mentalities, or else, right now it's not happening. Like, now we're playing around. We are messing around with the fundamental strings of life. Like, we're playing around. We're really doing, this is a very dangerous thing. I don't know how life is going to look like in the next,
Isn't that how humans have lived for thousands of years? I think that's correct.
Yeah, but now it's not. Now we're changing that. We're playing around with that. We're messing around with it. We're starting to really, try to change the way that happens. And I don't know what the consequences are going to be. I don't trust them to be good. Because we're so delicate as creatures. Like, a lot of this, psychologically, we need certain things that maybe we don't even acknowledge today that we need. Only recently did we find out that babies need skin on skin contact, right? When you go to the hospital, they tell you the lady should be shouldn't be wearing clothing, and the baby should be naked on her. Why? Medically, we have no understanding about that. We're starting to understand it, but we know why, because skin-on-skin contact. Babies that are, you can't have it robotically and mechanically done. The human touch is important, and the value and the quality of the human touch is important. Don't mess with that institution. It's very, the consequences can be catastrophic if you do. All right.
You had another opinion, and is it mainly because of the fact that, like, do we know of anybody during the Talibra Sultan that would mainly do written contracts?
No.
Or was basically everything
was verbal, and that's why it makes sense for them to hold the end of a marriage also verbally. But today, because all written, I side by the opinion that, and I'll detail that, inshallah, next time, who said this and all those stuff, that it's done by written contract. It has to be ended by written contract. So we end marriage just like we started. We sit down, we have witnesses to write, and we're going to end the marriage. So words, you're still going to get ithim, you're going to get sin for saying it, right, and not following up with it. But does it actually occur? I don't decide with the opinion that said it does, even though that's the majority of all schools of thought. It really is. But I don't think it's the, all respect, of course, to all the schools of thought, just based on the fact that I think a lot of the details of life have changed so dramatically that this, if we don't pay attention, we could start destroying families on a quicker rate. Like, we're already seeing the rise of divorce rates in Muslim world. So if we can come up with fiqhi rulings that will lessen that and hold on to families, I think we're obligated to do so. And not leaving the deen. Actually, following what the Quran is saying, and I'll give some evidence to support that next time. Well, I think we'll stop with that much today because I'm losing my voice, and we'll continue, inshallah, next Thursday. Next Thursday, maybe, we still have two more Thursdays. We have next Thursday and Thursday after, inshallah. Okay, subhanAllah, alhamdulillah.